50 years ago this September, Star Trek premiered on NBC. It lasted only 3 seasons, people forget that, but became a media phenomenon nonetheless, inspiring succeeding live-action TV series and movies. Much like the stories of Jules Verne, Star Trek fascinated viewers with its technology, science, and culture. Although placed in the 23rd century, we Earthlings are now using instruments and processes originally imagined by the creator and writers of the series, while our struggles with the issues of race and ideology it addressed in the 1960s continue. Joining us today to review the foresight of Star Trek is Kevin Dillmore. Besides his day job as a senior writer for Hallmark, Kevin is the author of over 20 Star Trek novels and short stories, many written with his friend Dayton Ward. They both will be at the Linda Hall Library this week. We'll have more on that a bit later. But first, Kevin Dillmore, welcome to Up to Date. So nice to have you here.
Hi, Steve. Thanks very much for having me around.
Well, here's this TV show and that takes place 200 years in the future in outer space, and it's a drama. The only other space-related program I can recall from that time is my favorite, Martian, and that was a sitcom. How tough a sell was it for creator Gene Roddenberry to get this show up on the air?
Well, I got to do one quick shout-out. Lost in Space was going on at the same time,
that's true.
And I'm sure you remember that.
Yes, I do.
Gene Roddenberry did have a tough time getting this going. He actually helped create an original pilot for Star Trek called The Cage that starred Jeffrey Hunter as Captain Pike rather than William Shatner as Captain Kirk, and that was deemed too cerebral. That's the quote, too cerebral by network executives. They did give him an opportunity, which happened fewer times than more, to create a second pilot, which he did that aired as an episode called Where No Man Has Gone Before. Hmm. And that pretty much set the stage for Star Trek as we imagine it from its original incarnation.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, the series was ahead of its time, both in content and in special effects and even props. It's kind of tough to pick up a starting point here, but let's go with some technology from the show. Kevin, the communicators the crew used, these were the small enough to be carried in one hand and flipped open just like cell phones would be 50 years later. How often was it a case of Roddenberry or the writer saying, they needed a gadget that could do this or that, and then left it up to the show's design crew to work up a creation for it?
I think that's absolutely what happened. A lot of times there were things like when they needed a scalpel for Dr. McCoy, some sort of laser scalpel, I think they resorted to salt and pepper shakers that were designed in a futuristic way. I know that when they came up with the idea, how do we get the people off and on the ship? We can't very well land this thing. That's expensive to show a model swooping in to the planets and all that stuff. They came up with the transporter. Let's just throw some glitter into a tank of water, stir it around, show that.
Is that what that was?
It absolutely was. And they just screened that against the silhouettes of the actors and actresses that were on the transporter pad, and voila, we're on the planet surface.
And that was so cool.
It was very cool. I mean, when we talk about technology in Star Trek, I think that that absolutely is the first thing that people come to mind as wanting.
You got to wonder, Kevin, have any cell phone manufacturers ever admitted that Star Trek was the inspiration behind the flip phone design?
Yeah, I don't know that anybody's come forward and said it, but there absolutely are people who are working on technology that say for sure their inspiration is Star Trek. I know that there is a device that is was invented by a Belgian innovator, Walter de Brouwer is his name, and he operates a company called Scanadu. And Scanadu has created basically a tricorder. I don't know if you remember handheld device that you saw Mr. Spock and Dr. McCoy hang on to quite a bit. They'd flip open the top and make this high-pitched squeal, and all of a sudden they knew everything they needed to know for the plot. It was amazing. But he was quoted when they were talking about his Scanadu device called the Scout, which truly is a medical tricorder. He said, I'm a baby boomer, and we looked at Star Trek as a business plan, not as a movie.
Wow. Well, and there's also a computer that understands voice commands and can talk with a human. And this was in an age when computing was still done with punch cards. How was this device critical to the series?
I think that one of the things that they had imagined when they gave the computer a human voice was that it humanized the technology. Technology is scary. It's still scary. We know people that don't want to do transactions financially across the internet. They don't even want their private lives exposed through Facebook or social media.
Right.
And by giving the computer a voice, which was the same thing that Stanley Kubrick did a few years later in 2001, A Space Odyssey, with HAL, who truly was a scary piece of technology.
Mm-hmm.
But it just brought it into something that I may not know how to press a button or run a punch card, but I know how to speak to a device.
How did you get interested in Star Trek to begin with? Where did that come from in your life?
For me, it came not with the original series. It came from the animated Star Trek series that was created it was created by Filmation.
Because you wouldn't guess that would be the case. You would think that the actual original series would be the thing that would grab you.
I'm just old enough that I was alive when it was aired, but I was
not alive enough. Yeah.
Well, I was two and a half. And the funny thing is that I absolutely remember watching Batman in the original run, and it came out at the same time. But I don't remember ever watching that, but I was eight or nine, when Filmation and NBC did the animated Star Trek series, which ran for, I believe, 22, 23 episodes in 1973, 74, and into 75. And they brought back the majority of the original cast to voice their cartoon characters, and that's absolutely what put the hook in me. I didn't know it was an actual live-action show until my across-the-street neighbor said, "You dummy, you know that's something they'd done before."
What hooked you about it? What was it that grabbed your imagination and your attention so effectively?
I'm confident when I was a kid, it was, well, an animated show absolutely has no budget, quote unquote, compared to the limitations of a live action show. They were able to show aliens on the bridge of the Enterprise, a guy with a third arm sticking out of his chest. You know, I mean, they had shuttlecraft that could go underwater. They had these belts that you press a button and you could walk around in all sorts of atmospheres. I thought that was really cool. But what I also picked up on was just these are smart people being smart. Gene Roddenberry absolutely looked at the future as a place where humanity would start to come into its own. And that was, I'm sure, what hooked me. They say that Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, in some respects, might represent the ego, superego, and id, as Freud lined out. And to watch the three of them talk out a problem and have Kirk come to a decision, I mean, wouldn't you love to be able to just think like that on the fly?
Yeah. We're visiting with Kevin Dillmore, who's a big Star Trek fan, a Hallmark employee as well, about all of this technology that Star Trek and the series created. He'll be one of the guests for this week's second Saturday conversation. It's called Of Tribbles and Technology, Star Trek at 50, in the auditorium at the Linda Hall Library. That's this Saturday beginning at 11. The event is free, but e-tickets are required. More information, just go to lindahall.org. That's this Saturday at 11 o'clock. I'll put that information out again later on this hour. So you began watching the series at that point in your life, and then you just kept following through with it?
I started reading more science fiction at that point. Mm. I mean, there was I lived in a small town in central Kansas. You know, this was in the 70s. We had, 12 channels when the weather was good.
Yeah.
And that was something that led me to a library. I started reading Robert Heinlein and Ray Bradbury. It absolutely motivated
Masters
me.
Masters of the genre, right?
I would absolutely regard them as that. And that led me into just science fiction in general. Watched the original series when I was growing up. Star Wars hit in 1977. Mm-hmm. I can't remember who the writer was that said it first, that the golden age of science fiction is 13. Whatever really fires you up at age 13 is probably what's going to stick with you for a long time, imagination-wise. I was watching Star Wars in the theater on my 13th birthday for the second time in 1977. So that was a big deal. Star Trek hit the big screens in 1979. And that's when I kind of looped into, when I was a kid, they said you can't like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. You got to like one or the other. And I think that sometimes hooks into fans on you can't like Star Wars and Star Trek, or one's got to be better than the other. And to me, they hit two very different notes for me. And so that Star Trek is something I've just carried around since then.
Talk to me about diagnostic scanners, going back to the technology that Star Trek helped help spur here. This was Dr. McCoy's medical scanner and the tricorder you've mentioned that could scan an area and detect life signs. What do we see today that does that? Or is there something like that?
There is. There's. We can do, boy, you're going to hit me with the science questions that I'm going to stumble through. But
like thermal imaging or something.
Ooh, that's a good one. The electrospectrography or something that I'm sure that there are scientific properties they do that. When I mentioned that Scout, that's the thing to me that is something I think is really cool. You can take a small device, press it to your temple, and deliver via Bluetooth to your smartphone your heart rate, your core body temperature, blood oxygenation levels, blood pressure, respiratory rates. And not only is that something that's interpreted by a device we know how to run, but we can kind of figure out whether do we need to go to the hospital? What if we do need to go to the hospital? Will my phone transfer that data to where I'm going so they're ready to receive me?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the opportunity for safety, the opportunity for just more comfort is what these kinds of things can provide to us.
That's interesting. We talked about the transporter a little bit ago. This is the piece of Star Trek technology maybe least likely to ever become reality. I mean, you know, dematerializing, then materializing a person or object from one location to another. Is there anything close to that happening today anywhere?
I mean, not that I'm aware. There's people who even talked about it philosophically because
that would
you
be
almost
so cool.
It would be awesome.
Solve a lot of problems.
But imagine
no KCI airport controversy in Kansas City if that was the case.
Yeah, you know, my guess is they'll still try to decide whether we need three or one terminals in the 23rd century. But the transporter physically deconstructs any object at the cellular level, sends it across in light rays, and reconstructs it, you know, at the new location. And if you are destroyed, do you really exist as yourself when you rematerialize? I mean, there's these philosophical things that people will loop into thinking about. Dr. McCoy does not trust the transporters. I think he's onto something.
Well, Kevin, in your own Star Trek stories, you've added to the existing technology with some inventions of your own. Or do you work with what's already been developed in the various series and movies, or have you brought new things to the table?
We very much work with the, and I say we because my writing partner Dayton Ward and I work together on the majority of the stuff that I write. We very much want to stay true to the look and feel of whatever era of Star Trek we're writing in, the 23rd century from the original series, the 24th for Next Generation, 22nd century when we're talking about the show Enterprise that followed the NX-01 with Scott Bakula back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Just even knowing what advancements there were between the 22nd, 23rd, and 24th is a little bit to sort through. But we generally will have the devices, the technology that's available to those characters at that point in time, and figure out ways to kind of interpret them to solve the next problem. How can you repurpose this to fix that? To be honest, it's no different from the way actual scientists will look at Star Trek or other science fiction.
So you're not really big on inventing new gadgets then?
Well, if we invent something new, it's generally something alien. Here's a device that can do this, and isn't it weird, and how do we try to figure out what makes it tick? The nice thing about the shows, the nice thing about writing fiction the way we do is we don't necessarily have to explain how it works. I mean, when Star Trek, when they say that warp drive works with dilithium crystals and matter and antimatter intermixed chambers and
exactly. Sure, it does.
Oh, absolutely
it does.
Yeah. They call that technobabble. So we try to get them to a point where somebody says, yeah, I'll bet Mr. Spock could figure that out, rather than actually, it's not like a Tom Clancy book where we're going to spend, you know, three or four pages talking about the intricacies of an M15 or something.
You know, Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry wanted to tackle serious issues through the medium of television. I was always wondering, why did he pick outer space in the 23rd century to do just that?
I think that was the masterstroke of why Star Trek is still relevant after 50 years, because we can look at things that are happening in the 23rd century and think, oh my gosh, that's a real problem. I'm glad we don't have to face that. Well, guess what? We are facing it. Roddenberry was one of the first people to, and the creators of Star Trek, he certainly was just one of them, but they were the first people to take on the issues of the Vietnam War on 1960s television. And nobody really got it because it was happening on an alien planet with Klingons and natives and Federation officers, and they just, it's an opportunity to kind of have that clean slate where the audience will relate to it more, you know, on Epsilon 9 than they will in Detroit, you know, because Detroit, I understand.
No, he included racism from the start, and in the most significant setting, and you know, in the most significant setting, the bridge of the Starship Enterprise. Pan the camera around that set, Kevin, and tell us just how diverse that crew was, because that was a remarkable thing.
It absolutely was, and it's something I think that that we should be thankful for, that they were willing to take risks like that. And I say risk because it sounds kind of funny in 2016 that that's risky behavior, but it was. I mean, there were audience members that might not watch if they saw an African American or a woman, in this case both, in a position of leadership and capability. We had George Takei playing Lieutenant Sulu,
who's been here any number of times on the show.
And he's headed to Kansas City next week.
That's right.
I'm excited to get a chance to see him again.
Yeah.
After the end of the first season, there was the teen edition of Pravda, which was the Soviet news agency, complained that if Star Trek is supposed to be representative of, you know, the future of mankind, how is it that the Russian or the Soviet contributions to space exploration are being ignored? And you can't. So beginning of the second season, he brought on Ensign Chekhov, who was very proud of his Russian heritage and absolutely responded to the idea that it wasn't just an American initiative, it was a worldwide initiative to get into the final frontier.
Tom from Westport, Kevin, wants to know if there's anything today like the phaser, the weapon used in Star Trek, that could have a stun setting like it had.
I tell you what, that'll be the first app I get on my iPhone. Wouldn't that be awesome?
Yeah.
Actually, I mean, I think that in some ways we have to look at a taser as being somewhat, inspired by that. There are some agencies, law enforcement, military, that use a device called a dazzler, that is a way to just kind of blind and disorient someone temporarily. Of course, there's rules that say you can't have a lethal device like that. And this is non-lethal. There are aircraft carriers today that are using high-powered lasers to defend from air and missile attacks. I think that the idea of a ray gun, which we think of when we think of the phaser that Captain Kirk uses to stun or kill, that may not necessarily be coming anytime soon, especially for commercial use.
We were talking about race a little bit ago, and I remember the famous kiss between Captain Kirk and
Lieutenant Uhura.
Lieutenant Uhura, am I saying that right?
Uhura, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that was a stunning moment on network television.
It was.
A white man kissing a black woman.
Mm-hmm. That happened in the third season episode called Plato's Stepchildren. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember if that aired in 1968 or 69, but it absolutely is something that, and both the performers, William Shatner and Nichelle Nichols, both say that was a very proud moment for them on Star Trek.
That's interesting.
To kind of challenge that barrier.
What was the reaction to it?
You know, I am not going to be able to come up with that off the top of my head.
Yeah.
We don't look at it as anything now. I think then it wasn't so much outrageous. It wasn't. They didn't have the instant outrage machine of social media for people to freak out. It's not like a Target changing its bathroom policy.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure there were letters to the network. I'm sure that there were people who claimed they would never watch it again. But telephone calls, of course, I'm sure hit the network of people being outraged. But as far as the volume of those voices, or how long that outrage lasted, I can't come up with that off the top of my head. I'm sorry.
So 50 years, 150 years from now, are we still going to be talking about Star Trek in one manifestation or another?
I think we will. We have characters in literature and popular culture, Tarzan, Sherlock Holmes, Mickey Mouse, Superman.
Who just endure, don't they?
They do. And I believe that Captain Kirk, Mr. Spock, the crew of the original Enterprise are always going to be around in one way or another.
Well, Kevin Dillmore is the author of over 20 Star Trek books and stories. He'll be one of the speakers at the Linda Hall Library at 11 o'clock Saturday morning for Of Tribbles and Technology, Star Trek at 50. The event is free, but e-tickets are required. More info, just go to lindahall.org. And Kevin, what a pleasure to have you. Thanks so much.
Pleasure's mine. Thanks a lot for the invitation.